Alas, alas, my child, most luckless creature on the face of the earth, Persephone is not deceiving you. She is the daughter of Zeus. But this is only what happens to mortals when one of us dies. As soon as the spirit leaves the white bones, the sinews no longer hold flesh and bones together. The blazing fire consumes them all. But the soul flits away, fluttering like a dream. Make haste back to the light. But do not forget all this. Tell it to your wife by and by. As we were talking together, a crowd of women came up, sent by awful Persephone, wives and daughters of great men. They gathered about the red blood, and I wondered how I should question them. This seemed to be the best plan. I drew my sword and kept off the crowd of ghosts, and then I let them form in a long line and come up one by one. Each one declared her lineage. Then I questioned them all. Tyro came first, that noble dame. She said she was daughter of Salmoneus and wife of Cretheus Iolides. But she was in love with Enipeus, the river god, most beautiful of all the rivers that flow on the earth. And she used to frequent the banks of this river. Poseidon Earthshaker took on him the shape of this river god and lay with her at the mouth of the eddying stream. A dark purple wave made an arch over them like a mountain cave to shelter the god and the mortal woman. He loosed her maiden girdle and made her fall into a deep sleep. When their love was fulfilled, he took her by the hand and said, "A blessing on your love, my dearest. When the year has rolled round, you shall bring forth glorious children, for a god's embrace is not barren. Nurse the boys and rear them with loving care. And now return to your home, keep it to yourself and say nothing, but know that I am Poseidon, Earthshaker." Then he dived into the billows of the deep. She conceived and brought forth Peleus and Neleus, who both became mighty servants of Zeus. Peleus dwelt in the broad spaces of Iolcus, rich in countless flocks of sheep, the other in sandy Pylos. She bore other sons as queen of King Cretheus, Aeson and Pheres and Amythaon, so famous with chariot and horses. Next to her I saw Antiope, the daughter of Esopus, who could boast that she had slept in the arms of Zeus, and she bore two boys, Amphion and Zethos. These two first founded the stronghold of Thebes with its seven gates and fortified it, since without walls and towers they could not live in spacious Thebes, mighty though they were. After her I saw Alcmene, the wife of Amphitryon, who brought forth Heracles, the indomitable lion-heart, when she had lain in the arms of mighty Zeus, and the daughter of proud Creon, Megara, who became the wife of Amphitryon's son, the hero whom no labor could weary. I saw the mother of Oedipus, fair Epicaste, who did a monstrous thing in the innocence of her heart, for she married her own son, and he had slain his own father first. But the gods kept it from people's knowledge for a time, so he continued to be king in his lovely Thebes, but full of misery himself by the gods' cruel will. And she went down to the strong prison of Hades, the warder of the gates. Her grief was too great for her, and she hanged herself from a lofty roof-beam. But she left him misery enough and to spare, which the avenging spirit of his mother brought to pass. And I saw beautiful Chloris, whom Neleus married for her beauty, bringing magnificent gifts. She was the youngest daughter of Amphioniasides, the powerful king of Minyan Orchomenos. She thus became queen of Pylos and bore him glorious sons, Nestor and Chromios and lordly Periclymenus. Besides these, she was the mother of buxom Pyrrho, the admiration of all beholders, wooed by every man within reach. But Neleus would give her to no man unless he would carry off the cows of Iphicles from Phylace, a dangerous task. Iphicles was a mighty man. The cows were all guarded, crumple-horned, broad-browed beauties. A certain admirable seer promised to drive them off all by himself, but hard fate caught him fast. There were the savage herdsmen and prison walls. Days and months went by, the year rolled round again, and the seasons came back to their places, and then King Iphicles let him go after he had uttered his oracles. So the will of Zeus came to pass. I saw Leda also, the wife of Tyndareus, who brought him two stout-hearted sons, Castor the horsemaster and Polydeuces the great boxer. These two were both buried in Mother Earth, and both alive. Even deep in the earth they have a special privilege from Zeus. One day living, and the next day dead. So they have the gods' own privilege. After her I saw Iphimedeia, the wife of Aeolus, who could say she had lain with Poseidon. She bore him two sons, but they had only a short time to live. These were the famous Otus and Ephialtes, the biggest creatures the fruitful earth ever bred, and the most handsome, next after famous Orion. At 9 years old they were 9 cubits across the chest and 9 fathoms high. They threatened to set up a horrible civil war against the immortals in Olympus. Their plan was to pile Ossa upon Olympus, and Pelion with its forest upon Ossa, and so to climb into heaven. Indeed, they would have done it, if they had lived, to grow up. But they were killed by Apollo, the son of Zeus and Leto, before the down began to grow under their temples and the hair upon their chins. I saw Phaedra and Procris and fair Ariadne, the daughter of grim-hearted Minos, whom Theseus carried off from Crete. He was taking her to Athenian soil, but he had no joy of her, for Artemis slew her first in the island of Dia, because Dionysus told tales. Myrrha, too, I saw. And Clymene, and accursed Eriphyle, who accepted gold as the price of her own husband. I will not stay to name all I saw, wives or daughters of heroes, or night would end before I had done. It is time to sleep now, either here or on board the ship. And tomorrow, please God, you will arrange for my homeward voyage. When he had done, there was silence in the shadows of the hall, for they were all enchanted by the story. After a while, Aretha began to speak. "What do you think of him now, gentlemen?" she said. "Isn't he a fine figure of a man, and clever enough for anything? Now he is my guest, but you all have your share of the honor, so don't be in a hurry to let him go, and don't stint your gifts, which he needs so much. You have plenty of good things in store, thanks be to heaven." Echeneus followed up and said, "My friends, what our wise queen says is not far from the mark, just what we might expect. You should do as she bids you. But here is Alcinous, and all that we say or do depends on him." Alcinous answered at once, "Well, this shall certainly be done if I am still alive and king over the seafaring Phaeacians. But let our guest make up his mind to stay at least over tomorrow, however anxious he may be to get home, and that will give me time to bring all our gifts together. To give him a safe journey is the concern of the whole nation, but mine most especially, since mine is the chief power in the land." Odysseus answered readily, "Most illustrious prince, if you should bid me to stay here for a 12-month, while you are making full preparations for the voyage and heaping your bounty upon me, that is just what I should choose. The fuller my hands, the better welcome I should find when I came home. They would all think the more of me and love me better when they saw me in Ithaca, safe and sound." To this Alcinous replied, "My dear Odysseus, to see you is quite enough to show that you are no cheat or impostor like so many others. There is a rich crop of such men flourishing on the fat soil of this world, who dress up fabulous tales about what no eye could ever see. But there is the spirit of honest truth about your story, as well as the artist's finish, and you have told it like a poet who understands his craft. What a sad story of your own travels and the whole Argive nation. But now, be so kind as to tell us something more. Did you see any of your noble comrades who were at Ilion with you and there met their fate? There is any amount of this long night before us. It is not time for bed yet. Please, go on with your tale of marvels. I could listen till daylight should appear, if you would have the patience to finish your touching story under this roof." Odysseus was ready to play up to him and answered, "Most illustrious prince, there is a time for long stories, and there is a time for sleep. But if you wish to hear, I would not grudge you a story even more touching. the misfortunes of those who perished afterwards, when they had come safe out of the perils of the battlefield and returned home, only to fall by the treachery of a woman. Very well, then. As soon as dread Persephone had dispersed the ghosts of the women, the ghost of Agamemnon Atrides came near full of sorrow. There was a crowd of others round him, those who died with him in the house of Aegisthus. The king knew me as soon as he had drunk the red blood. He cried aloud and wept, stretching out his hands toward me and trying to reach me. But there was no strength or power left in him, such as there used to be in that body so full of life. I shed tears of pity myself when I saw him, and spoke plainly, as I called him by name. "My lord Atrides, Agamemnon, king of men, what fate of dolorous death brought you low? Did Poseidon raise a terrible tempest and drown you in the sea? Or did the hand of an enemy strike you down on dry land in some foray or cattle raid or fighting for conquest and captives?" He answered, "Prince Laertiades, Odysseus ever ready, Poseidon did not drown me in the sea. No enemy struck me down on dry land, but Aegisthus plotted my death with my accursed wife, invited me to his house, set me down to a banquet, butchered me as if I were an ox at the manger. That was how I died, and a shameful death it was. My friends were falling all around me, like a lot of Tusker pigs that a rich man slaughters for a wedding or a banquet or a butty meal. You have seen men fall in battle often enough, killed man to man or in the thick melee, but you never saw a sight so pitiable as that. As we lay about the wine bowl, and the tables were piled with meats, and the floor running with blood. Most frightful of all was the shriek of Cassandra, and she a king's daughter. I heard it when the traitress Clytemnestra killed her over my body. I tried to lift my hands, but dropped them again on the ground as I lay dying with a sword through my body. The bitch turned her back. She would not take the trouble to draw down my eyelids or to close my mouth in death. True it is, there is nothing so cruel and shameless as a woman. That woman proved it to be true when she plotted that shameful deed and murdered her lawful husband. Ah me, I did think to find welcome with my children and household when I came back to my home. But she had set her mind upon outrageous wickedness. She had brought shame on herself and all women forever, even if one of them is honest. I cried out, "Mercy upon us! Indeed, there is no doubt that Zeus all-seeing has been the deadly foe of the house of Atreus from the beginning, and he has always used the schemes of women. For Helen's sake, how many of us fell, and for you, Clytemnestra was laying her plot while you were far away." He answered, "Then take warning now yourself, and never be too kind, even to your wife. Never tell her all you have in your mind. You may tell something, but keep something to yourself. However, you will not be murdered by your wife, Odysseus. She is full of intelligence, and her heart is sound, your prudent and modest Penelope. Ah, she was a young bride when we left her and went to the war. There was a baby boy at her breast, and I suppose by this time he counts himself a man. Happy boy! His father will see him when he comes, sure enough, and he will give his father a kiss, as a good boy should. But my wife would not even let me delight my eyes with the sight of my son. She killed the father first. But there is something I want very much to know. Have you heard anything about my sons being alive somewhere in Orchomenos, or in sandy Pylos, or perhaps with Menelaus in Sparta? My Orestes is certainly not dead yet." I said, "Why do you ask me that, Atrides? I know nothing whether he is alive or dead, and it is a bad thing to babble like the blowing wind." As we two stood talking together of our sorrows in this mournful way, other ghosts came up. Achilles, and Patroclus, and Antilochus, the man without stain and without reproach. And Aeus, who was most handsome and noble of all next to the admirable Achilles. The ghost of Achilles knew me, and said in plain words, "Here is Prince Odysseus, who never fails. Oh, you foolhardy man, your ingenious brain will never do better than this. How did you dare to come down to Hades, where dwell the dead, without sense or feeling, phantoms of mortals whose weary days are done?" I answered him, "My lord Achilles Pylades, our chief and champion before Troy, I came to ask Tiresias if he had any advice or help for me on my way to my rugged island home, for I have not yet set foot in my own country, since trouble has ever been my lot. But you, Achilles, are most blessed of all men who ever were or will be. When you lived, we honored you like the gods. And now you are a potentate in this world of the dead. Then do not deplore your death, Achilles." He answered at once, "Don't bepraise death to me, Odysseus. I would rather be ploughman to a yeoman farmer on a small holding than lord paramount in the kingdom of the dead. But do tell me something about that fine son of mine. Did he go to the war and take a leading place or not? And tell me of my noble old father. Have you heard anything of Peleus? Does he still hold his honorable place among the Myrmidons, or have they lost respect for him throughout the land because his hands and feet are stiff with age? For I am no longer under the sun to help him, strong as I once was on the battlefield of Troy, when I struck down the best of them and defended our people. Let me be for a short time in my father's house, strong as I once was, and I would make not a few fear my anger and my invincible hands, if they are keeping him by force from his honor due." I answered, "I have nothing to tell you of your noble father Peleus, but I can tell you about your beloved son Neoptolemus, and there is nothing to hide. In fact, I brought him in my own ship from Scyros to join the Achaean army. When we held a council of war, he was always the first to speak and always found the right thing to say. Only Nestor and I were superior. When we met our enemies in battle, he did not lag among the crowd or in the scrimmage, but showed himself well in front, the bravest of the brave. Many a man he killed in fair fight. I will not name all those he killed on the field, but what a man was brought low when he ran his sword through Eurypylus Telephides, that young hero. And many others of his people fell by his side, that a woman might enjoy her gewgaws. That was the handsomest man I ever saw, except Memnon the Magnificent. And when the best men of our army were about to enter the wooden horse, which Epeus made, and I was put in charge to open and close the door as I thought fit, the other captains were wiping tears from their eyes and trembling in every limb. But I saw no pallor on his cheeks, and no tear in his eyes. Again and again he begged me to let him out, and handled his sword hilt and heavy spear, eager to have at his enemies. When at last we had sacked the city, he took his share of the spoil and a special prize, and embarked unwounded, with never a scratch from sword or spear, although there are plenty of those in war. You take your luck when war runs amok. When I told him this, the ghost of clean-heeled Achilles marched away with long steps over the meadow of Asphodel, proud to hear how his son had made his mark. The other ghosts of the dead halted in turn, and each asked what was near to his heart. But alone of them all, the soul of Aeus Telamonides kept apart, still resentful for my victory over him when there was question about the arms of Achilles. The goddess, his mother, set them up as a prize for the best man. How I wish I had never won such a prize. What a life was lost for that. Aeus, first of all the Danaans, in noble looks and noble deeds, except Achilles the incomparable. And so I addressed him in gentle words. "Aeus, great son of a great father, were you never to forget your anger against me for those accursed arms, not even in death? That prize was a disaster, seeing that we lost a tower of strength like you. Our whole nation mourns your loss continually, no less than we mourn Achilles Pylades." Zeus alone is to blame and no one else, because he hated the Danaan host so vehemently and brought fate upon you. Nay, come this way, my lord, and listen to my pleading. Master your passion and your proud temper." He replied not a word, but moved away into Erebus after the other ghosts of the dead. Then, in spite of all, he should have spoken to me, or I to him, but I wished to see the souls of the others who were dead. There I saw Minos, the glorious son of Zeus, holding a golden rod and giving sentence upon the dead. He was seated, and the dead were around him in the house of Hades, with its wide portals, some seated and some standing, as each asked the judge for his decision. After him I noticed the huge figure of Orion driving the beasts in a mass over the meadow of Asphodel, the game which he had killed himself when he was alive on the lonely hills. His hands held a cudgel of solid bronze, unbroken forever. And Sortitius, the son of Gaea, most majestic, lying upon the ground. 9 roods he covered, and 2 vultures sat one on each side and tore his liver, plunging under the skin. He could not defend himself with his hands. This was his punishment because he had laid violent hands on Leto, the famous consort of Zeus, when she was passing through the beautiful grounds of Panopeus on her way to Pytho. Tantalus also I saw in his misery, standing in a lake up to his chin, always thirsty. But try as he would, not a drop could he lap up. For as often as the poor old man dipped his head to take a drink, the water was sucked back and disappeared, until the dark earth showed under his feet, as fate dried it away. Tall trees in full leaf dangled their fruit over his head, pears and pomegranates and fine juicy apples, sweet figs and ripe olives. But as often as the poor old man reached out a hand to catch one, the wind tossed them all up to the clouds. Sisyphus also I saw, and his tedious task, as he held up a monstrous stone with both hands. Scrambling with his feet and pushing with his hands, he heaved the stone up the hill. But just as he was about to topple it over the crest, the weight was too much for him, and turned it back. Down along to the ground rolled the stone pitiless. Then he would push again, stretching and struggling, with sweat pouring off every limb and the dust rising from his head. After him I saw mighty Heracles, his phantom, that is. But Heracles himself is with the immortal gods, as happy as the day is long, with graceful youth for his bride. Around this phantom the ghosts were gibbering and twittering like a flock of birds, and scattering hither and thither. He stood holding his naked bow with arrows on string, looking as black as night, and casting dreadful glances round, for ever as if just about to shoot. A terrible baldric was round about his chest, a golden strap covered with wonderful work, bears and wild boars and glaring lions, battles and conflicts and bloody death. May the artist never invent another work of art who made that terrible baldric by his genius. The hero knew me when he caught sight of me, and sped his words straight to the mark. "Prince Laertiades, Odysseus, never failing, I pity you, for you are dogged by an evil fate as I was under the light of the sun. My father was Zeus Cronion, yet I had infinite tribulation to endure, for I was bound to a contemptible fellow who set me dangerous labors. Once he sent me here for the dog, because he thought he could find no more dangerous labor than that. I brought him up, I got him from Hades, sure enough, under conduct of Hermias and Pallas Athena." With these words he strode back into the house of Hades. But I remained where I was, in case any other of the heroes of past times should appear. And indeed I should have seen others of those ancient men whom I wished especially to see, as Theseus and Peirithous, those famous sons of gods. But before I could see them, the innumerable hosts of the dead gathered together with deafening cries. And I grew pale with fear that awful Persephone might send out to Hades upon me a gorgon head of some dreadful monster. Then I went back at once to the ship, and told my men to loose the hawser and get away. They were soon rowing steadily on their benches, and the current bore us steadily down the ocean stream, oars at first, afterwards a following breeze. Book 12. The Singing Sirens and the Terrors of Scylla and Charybdis. Our ship left the stream of Oceanus and passed into the open sea. Soon it came to the island of Aeaea, where Dawn has her dwelling and her dancing lawns, and Helios his place of rising. We ran up the ship and went ashore to sleep on the beach. As soon as the next day dawned, I sent my companions to Circe's house to bring the body of Elpenor. We cut chunks of wood for a pyre, and buried him on the end of the foreland, mourning for our dead friend. And when the body was burnt with his arms, we raised a barrow with a large stone upon it, and set up his own oar on the summit. While we were busy there, Circe did not fail to learn that we had come back from Hades. She soon came down, well provided. The servants brought a load of bread and meat and sparkling red wine. Then, standing among us, she said, "You men stick at nothing. So you went down to Hades alive, double dyers when other people are content to die once. Come now, eat and drink once more. All the day is before you, and tomorrow at dawn you shall sail. I will describe the way. I will tell you every single thing, that you may not make mischief for yourselves and come to grief by land or sea." We were quite ready to comply, so all the day long till sunset we enjoyed our feast of good things. When the sun set and darkness came, they all lay down where the ship was moored, but Circe took me apart and made me tell the story of our voyage as we sat together. I told her everything just as it happened, and at the end she said, "Very well, all that is finished and done with. Now listen to what I have to say, and you will not forget it, please God. First you will come to the sirens, who bewitch everyone who comes near them. If any man draws near in his innocence and listens to their voice, he never sees home again. Never again will wife and little children run to greet him with joy, but the sirens bewitch him with their melodious song. There in a meadow they sit, and all round is a great heap of bones, mouldering bodies, and withering skins. Go on past that place, and do not let the men hear. You must knead a good lump of wax and plug their ears with pellets. If you wish to hear them yourself, make the men tie up your hands and feet and fasten your body tight to the mast, and then you can enjoy the song as much as you like. Tell them that if you shout out and command them to let you loose, they must tie you tighter with a few more ropes. When you have got clear of them, there is a choice of two courses, and I will not lay down for you which to take. Use your own judgment. I will just say what they are. One course will bring you to a pair of precipitous rocks, washed by the boisterous breakers of dark-eyed Amphitrite. The gods call them the moving rocks. Not a bird can pass between them, not even the timorous doves, which carry the ambrosia to Father Zeus. One of these is always caught between the towering rocks, and the father sends in another to keep the number right. No ship sailed by men that came that way has ever escaped. But timbers and dead bodies are all carried away by the rolling seas and tempests of blazing fire. Only one ship ever sailed through, the well-known Argo on her voyage to Aeetes, and she also would have been wrecked on the rocks, but Hera took her safely through because Jason was her friend. The other course leads between two cliffs. One drives a sharp peak high into the heavens, and black clouds are round about it. The clouds never disperse, and that peak is never clear, either in summer or in autumn. No mortal man could climb up, no man climb down, not if he had 20 hands and 20 feet, for the stone is smooth as if it had been polished. But in the side of the cliff is a dark, gloomy cave, facing the west towards Erebus, just where you will steer your ship, Odysseus. There Scylla dwells, and yelps in her dreadful way. The cave is so high that the strongest man could not reach it with an arrow shot from the ship. It is true her voice is no louder than a puppy dog newborn, but she is a horrible monster. Such a sight could give pleasure to no one, not even one of the immortal gods. She has 12 flapping feet and 6 necks, enormously long, and at the end of each neck a horrible head with 3 rows of teeth, set thick and close, full of black death. She is hidden in the cave as far as the waist, but she pokes out her heads from the gloomy depths, and there she fishes, hunting all round for dolphins and swordfish, or any of those leviathans of the deep which Amphitrite breeds in thousands. No seaman can boast that they have escaped scot-free from her. She grabs a poor wretch with each head out of the ship as it sails along. The other cliff is lower, as you will see, Odysseus. They are not far from one another. You could shoot an arrow across. There is a wild fig tree growing from it, a tall tree covered with leaves, and Charybdis underneath swallows down the black water. 3 times a day she spouts it out, 3 times a day she swallows it down. She is a terror. Don't you be there when she swallows. No one could save you from destruction, not Earthshaker himself. You had much better go by Scylla's rock. Keep close and be quick about it. To lose 6 of your crew is much better than to lose them all at once. I answered, "What do you say to this, my goddess? Suppose I slip away from Charybdis and show fight when the other attacks my men." She answered at once, "You hothead, fighting and asking for trouble is all you care about. Will you stand up even to the immortal gods? She is no mortal, I tell you, but an immortal fiend, dangerous, deadly, savage, invincible. There is no help for it. Flight is better than fight. If you stay too long near the rock while you put on your armor, I am afraid she may shoot out another half-dozen heads and catch another half-dozen fellows. No, no, row as hard as you can, and call for help on Crateus, that is Scylla's mother. She produced that abomination. Crateus will stop her from trying again. You will come next to the island of Thrinacia, where the herds of Helios feed. There are his cattle and great sheep, 7 herds of cattle and 7 fine flocks of sheep, 50 in each. These never have young and never die. Their shepherds are 2 goddesses, nymphs with lovely hair, shining Phaethusa and bright Lepetii, daughters of Helios Hyperion by divine Neaera, ever young. When the mother had brought up her children, she sent them away to that far-off island to look after their father's cattle and sheep. If you leave these unharmed and attend to the business of getting home, you may yet reach Ithaca, although not without suffering. But if you do any damage, then I foretell destruction for ship and men. You may save your own life, but if you do, you will reach your home late and miserable, and all your companions will be lost. As she said these words, the dawn rose enthroned in gold. Circe went away up the island, and I to the ship, where I awakened my companions and bade them embark and cast off the moorings. They were soon on board and in their places. Circe, our beautiful goddess, who could speak to us men in our own language, sent us the best of companions, a fair wind to fill our sails. All was snug and ship-shape. We sat still and let the wind carry us on while the steersman kept the course. I was anxious enough, of course, and so I spoke to the men. "My friends, the divine Circe has told me all about what is going to happen, and I do not think it right that only 1 or 2 should know. So I will tell you all, and when we all know, we may die or escape, as the case may be. First, she bids us keep away from the sirens with their wonderful voices and their flowery meadow. I alone must hear them, so she said, but you are to bind me with strong ropes and fasten me upright against the mast so that I shall not be able to move. If I implore you and order you to set me free, you must tie me up tighter than ever." So I explained everything to my companions, and by this time the ship was drawing near to the Sirens' Isle, travelling briskly, for there was no fault to be found with the wind. Then the wind fell all at once, and there was a dead calm, not a ripple on the water. My men rolled up the sail and stowed it below, and they were soon rowing away white foam and splashing oars. Then I took a thick round of wax and chopped it up with my sword into pellets and molded the bits in my fingers. The wax grew soft as it was warmed by the effulgence of my lord Helios Hyperionides, and I plugged up the ears of all the men one after another. Then they bound me hand and foot and fastened me upright against the mast, took their places, and paddled on. But when she was as far off the land as a voice could carry, and going at a good pace, the sirens saw us coming, and raised their melodious song. Come this way, most admirable Odysseus, glory of the nation. Stay your ship and listen to our voice. No man ever yet sailed past this place without first listening to the voice which sounds from our lips, sweet as honey. No, he has a great treat and goes home a wiser man, for we know all that the Argives and Trojans endured on the plains before Troy by the will of heaven, and we know all that shall come to pass on the face of Mother Earth. So they sang in lovely tones. From the bottom of my heart I longed to listen, and I ordered the men to set me free, nodding my head and working my brows. But they simply went on pulling with a good swing. Perimedes and Eurylochus at once got up and put more ropes round me and fastened me tighter. But when we had gone a long way past the sirens, so that we could hear them no longer, my companions took out the wax from their ears and untied my ropes. At last we left the island behind, and suddenly I saw smoke and a great rolling wave and heard a loud noise. The men were terrified. The oars flew out of their hands and fell in the sea with a splash, dragging down at the ship's sides by their loops. She made no way. Now the oars drove no longer. I walked down the whole length of the ship, pausing by each man and coaxing them not to lose heart. My friends, we are not unacquainted with trouble. This is no greater danger than when the Cyclops imprisoned us in his cave by brute force. We escaped from that place, thanks to my courage and my ingenious plan, and I think we shall live to remember this, no less. Now then, attend to my instructions. Keep your seats and row away like men, and then we may hope that Zeus will save and deliver us out of this danger. Now, for you, steersman, pay careful heed, for you hold our helm in your hands. Keep her well away from the smoke and surge, and hug the cliffs. Whatever you do, don't let her run off in that direction, or we shall all be drowned. They did my bidding at once, but I took care not to mention Scylla, and the peril we could not avoid. I thought they would be likely to leave the oars in a panic and huddle down below. At that moment, I quite forgot Circe's injunction. When she told me not to arm myself, I put on my armor and caught up a couple of spears and took my stand on the foredeck, for that was where I thought Scylla would show herself on the rock, bringing death for my companions. But I could not see her anywhere, though I dazed my eyes with staring about me through the clouds at the rock. We passed up the strait, groaning loudly, for on one side was Scylla, on the other Charybdis swallowed up the salt water in terrible fashion. When she spouted, like a cauldron over a great fire, she seethed up in a swirling mess, and the spray rose high in the air till it fell on the tops of the two cliffs. When she swallowed up the salt sea, she showed deep down in her swirling whirlpool black sand at the bottom, and the rocks all round echoed a bellowing boom. Every man was pale with fear. As we gazed in our fear at the death on this side, at the same moment Scylla grabbed six of my men out of the ship, the best and strongest of the crew. I turned, took a glance at the ship, looked for my men, saw their hands and feet already in the air, swinging aloft in the clutches of Scylla, while they called aloud on my name for the last time in despair. As a fisherman stands on a projecting rock with a long rod and throws in ground bait to attract the little fishes, then drops in hook and line with its horn bait, and at last gets a bite and whips him out gasping, so Scylla swung them gasping up to the rock. There in the cave she devoured them, shrieking and stretching out their hands to me in the death struggle. That was the most pitiable sight my eyes ever beheld in all my toils and troubles on the weary ways of the sea. When we were past the rocks and away from the terrors of Charybdis and Scylla, immediately we reached a delectable island. In that place were the fine cattle with broad brows and the great sheep which belonged to Helios Hyperion. While we were still a long way off, I heard the lowing of the cattle penned for the night and the bleating of sheep. And I remembered the warning of the blind prophet, Theban Tiresias, and of E and Circe, and how they strictly forbade me to land on the island of Helios, the joy of man. At once I said to my companions, with my mind full of foreboding, "Men, you are having a hard time of it, I know that, but listen to me a moment. I want to tell you a warning of Tiresias and of Circe also. They strictly forbade us to land on the island of Helios, for there, they said, an awful danger awaits us. You had better give the island a wide berth and row on." This fairly broke them down, and Eurylochus answered at once, angrily, "You are a hard man, Odysseus, never downhearted and never tired. You must be made of iron. Here are your men, tired to death and scarce able to keep awake, and you won't let us go ashore on this island and cook a square meal. No, you make us go traipsing along the whole blessed night. We must give the island a wide berth and toss about in the dark. Night is the time for dangerous squalls. That's the way ships are lost. How can we expect to get off with our lives if a sudden squall comes out of the south or west? Damned bad winds that send the ship to the bottom, God willing or not. I vote we take our orders from Black Madam Night, pull up the vessel and cook a meal. Then, in the morning, in we get, and it's over the sea we go." That was the proposal of Eurylochus, and the others applauded. Then I understood that heaven had trouble in store for us, and I gave it him straight. "Eurylochus, I must give way to force. I am one against many. But you must swear a solemn oath that if we find a herd of cattle or a flock of sheep, no one shall dare to kill one cow or one sheep. You must keep quiet and eat the food that Circe gave us." They all swore the oath accordingly, and when that business was done, we brought the ship into a landlocked harbor close to a spring of sweet water. They all went ashore and prepared their meal in proper style. When they had taken all they wanted, they had time to remember their lost comrades, whom Scylla had caught and eaten out of the ship, and they lamented their dead until welcome sleep overcame them. But when it was the third watch of the night and the stars had moved south, Zeus, cloud-gatherer, sent out a furious wind in a regular tempest and covered earth and sea with clouds. Night rushed down from the heavens. As soon as the dawn showed ruddy through the mist, we hauled the ship ashore into a cave in which the nymphs had their thrones and dancing rings. Then I called the men together and addressed them. "My friends, we have food and drink in the ship, so we must keep our hands off these cattle, or we may suffer for it. For an awful god is the owner of these cattle and great sheep, Helios, who sees all and hears all." They were quite willing to agree, but the south wind blew for a whole month without changing, and after that never a breath of any wind we had but east and south. So long as the food and red wine lasted, they kept their hands off the cattle, for they did not want to die. But when all the provisions on board were consumed, and they had to go about hunting for game, birds, or fish, or whatever fell to their hands or their hooks, and they were half-starved, I made my way up into the island to offer prayer to the gods and try whether one would help us. I slipped away from the men and found a place with shelter from the wind. There I washed my hands and prayed to all the gods who dwell in Olympus. But they made me fall into a deep sleep. Meanwhile, Eurylochus was making a fatal speech to his companions. "My friends," he said, "you are in a bad way, but let me say a word to you. All deaths are hateful to miserable mortals, but the most pitiable death of all is to starve. Come along, let us drive off the best of these cattle and sacrifice them to the immortal gods who rule the broad heavens. If we ever return home to Ithaca, we will build a rich temple to Helios Hyperion and set up there many handsome offerings. But if the god is angry about his straight horns and wants to destroy our ship, and if the other gods agree, I choose rather to die once with a mouthful of salt water than to be slowly squeezed out in a desert island." The others applauded this speech. They wasted no time, but drove off the best of the cattle of Helios close by, for the fine beasts with their wide foreheads and crumpled horns used to graze not far off. The men stood round the cattle and prayed to the gods, but they had no barley meal to sprinkle upon their victims, so they used tender young oak leaves which they picked from a tree. They had no wine to pour over the burnt offering, but they sprinkled water before they cooked the tripes. Then they chopped up the rest and put the pieces on spits. At that moment I awoke and came back to the seashore. As I came near to the ship, a sweetish odor of burning fat was diffused around me. I cried aloud in horror and prayed to the immortal gods, "Father Zeus and all you blessed gods that live forever, you meant my ruin when you made me fall into that cruel sleep. My men, whom I left behind, have committed a monstrous crime." A messenger took the news quickly to Helios Hyperion, Lampetii in her flowing robe, and she told him we had slain his cattle. In great anger he called out to the immortals, "Father Zeus and all ye gods that live forever, punish those men of Odysseus Laertiades. They have brutally killed my cattle, which were my great delight when I climbed into the starry sky and when I turned back to earth from heaven. If they do not pay me a fitting compensation, I will just go down to Hades and show my light among the dead." Zeus Cloud-Gatherer answered him, "Now then, Helios, you just go on showing your light to us immortals and to mortal men upon Mother Earth. I will soon strike the ship with a thunderbolt and smash it into smithereens in the middle of the sea." I was told this later by Calypso. She said she heard it herself from Hermes, King's messenger. As soon as I came down to the seashore, I reproached them one and all. Though we could do nothing to help it now, the cattle were already dead. But awful portents were seen in that place. The skins crawled. The meat bellowed on the spits, both raw and roast. It was like the noise of cattle. 6 days my companions feasted on the best of the cattle of Helios. But when the seventh day came, the furious tempest ceased. We embarked and went sailing away over the sea. When the island was far astern and no other land to be seen, nothing but sea and sky, Cronion brought a black cloud over our ship and darkened the deep. Then she did not run long, for suddenly came the west wind, screeching and blowing with a furious tempest. The gale broke both the forestays, the mast fell aft, and all the tackle tumbled into the hold. The mast hit the steersman's head and crushed the skull to splinters. He took a header from his deck and was drowned. Zeus at the same time thundered and struck our ship with his bolt. She shivered in all her timbers at the blow, and the place was full of sulphur. The men were cast out. There they were, bobbing up and down on the waves like so many crows. So God ended the homeward voyage for them. I kept pacing up and down the ship until the sea tore the sides from the keel. A rolling wave carried her along, dismantled and snapped off the mast close to the keel. But the backstay had fallen upon it. This was made of stout oxhide, so I used it to lash together keel and mast, and I rode upon these, drifting before those terrible winds. Now the furious tempest of the west wind was lulled, and the south quickly followed, bringing anxiety for me, for it was sure to carry me back again to the terrors of Charybdis. All night long I drifted, and by sunrise Scylla and dreadful Charybdis were before me. Charybdis swallowed up the salt water, but I had been carried high up and caught the wild fig tree, and I stuck to it like a bat and held tight. I had nothing to plant my feet upon for support and no way to climb, for the roots were far below and the branches far above, those thick, long branches which overshadowed Charybdis. But I held tight without slackening until my mast and keel should be spouted up again. How I longed for them, and they came at last. At the time when a judge gets up from court for his dinner, after settling the morning's disputes among quarrelsome young men, just at that time my spars appeared out of Charybdis. I spread out hands and feet and let go and came down plump in the water alongside the spars, then clambered up and lay on them paddling with my hands. What of Scylla? The father of gods and men would not allow her to set eyes on me, or I should not have escaped with my life. From that place I drifted for 9 days, and on the 10th, at night, the gods brought me to the island of Ogygia. There dwells Calypso, that goddess so beautiful and so terrible, who can speak the language of man. And she loved me and cared for me. But why go on with my story? I have told it already, and no one cares for a twice-told tale. Book 13. How Odysseus Came to Ithaca. He finished, and all were silent, as if spellbound in the shadowy hall. At last Alcinous spoke.
"Well, Odysseus, since you have come as far as my brazen walls and lofty roof, I don't think you will look a foiled adventurer when you get home, even if you have had plenty of trouble. And now, gentlemen, I have a bolt in my quiver for you, who have always been welcome to drink my best company wine and to hear my musician. The clothes are all packed in that coffer for our guest, with the fine gold plate and all the other gifts which our counselors have brought. I propose now that we offer him a large tripod and a cauldron apiece. We will collect the cost afterwards in the town. It would be too bad to let each man bear it all himself."
They were quite content with this proposal and dispersed to their homes for the night. As soon as the first rosy fingers of dawn appeared, they made haste to the ship with the useful brassware. Alcinous was careful to stow away these things with his own royal hands, packing them under the benches so that the men might not damage them in rowing. Then the givers went on to the royal mansion and made ready for their banquet. The king's grace sacrificed an ox to our lord Zeus Cronides, who dwells in clouds and darkness. When they had burnt the thigh slices, they had a famous feast and enjoyed it mightily, while Demodocus made music for them, such as they always loved to hear. Odysseus turned his head ever and anon to the shining sun, impatient for his setting, for he was eager to be gone. As a man longs for his meal, when all through the day his brown oxen draw the plough over the fallow field, until his knees fail under him while he plods along, and he is glad to see the sun set and leave him to his dinner, so Odysseus was glad to see the sun set. At once he addressed the company, Alcinous in particular, and said, "My lord Alcinous, most illustrious prince, now pour out your libations, and let me go in peace, and good be with you all. For what my heart desired has been now brought to pass, a friendly escort and friendly gift, which may the gods in heaven bless. May I return to my home and find my faithful wife and my dear ones safe and sound. May you who remain make happy your own wives and children, and may the gods grant you success of every sort, and may no evil thing befall your people." All applauded this prayer, and urged the king to speed their guest on his way after his admirable words. Then King Alcinous said to the herald, "Pontonous, mix a bowl and serve round to all in hall, that every one may offer a prayer to Father Zeus, and speed our guest on his way to his native land." Then Pontonous mixed the honey-hearted wine and served it to all in turn. They poured the sacred drops to the blessed gods who rule the broad heavens, each man from his own seat. But Odysseus rose and passed the two-handled cup to Arete, saying to her, "May it be well with you, queen, for ever, until old age and death shall come as they come to all men. Now I depart. A blessing on you in this house, and your children, and your people, and their king, Alcinous." With these words, Odysseus stepped over the threshold. King Alcinous sent the herald with him to lead him to the seashore where the ship lay, and Arete sent with him three of her women, one bearing a tunic and a robe newly washed, another to convey the coffer, a third with a supply of bread and red wine. At the seaside where the ship lay, the young men of his escort received all this and stowed it away on board with the food and drink, and they laid a blanket and sheet on the deck of the poop for Odysseus that he might sleep soundly. Odysseus went on board in silence and laid himself down, while the crew took their places and cast off the hawser, drawing it through the hole in the stone pillar. Then they paddled away with a good swing back. Blessed sleep fell on his eyelids, deep, sound, and most sweet, the very image of death. And the ship, as four fine stallions in a team leap like one when touched up with the whip and gallop along the road with bounding paces, So her stern bounded aloft on the purple wave which followed big over the sounding sea. Steady and straight she ran. Not even the peregrine falcon could have kept up with her, and he is the most rapid of all winged things. So she cut swiftly through the waves, and she carried a man whose mind was as wise as the gods. Long years he had suffered great tribulation and sorrow of heart, wars on land and voyages over the stormy seas, and now he slept quietly, forgetting all his troubles. When that brightest of stars rose which comes to tell us that the dawn is near, the traveling ship was drawing close to an island. There is a harbor of Phorcys, the old man of the sea, in the island of Ithaca. Two headlands enclose it, with steep sides sloping down to the harbor mouth, to shelter it from the waves which boisterous winds may raise outside. Once inside, ships of good size can lie without mooring when they come within mooring distance. At the head of this harbor is an olive tree covered with its long leaves, and near the tree is a beautiful dusky cave sacred to the nymphs, who are called naiads. In the cave are great bowls and two-handled jars of stone, and in these the bees hive their honey. There are also tall poles of stone like the beams of a loom, where the nymphs weave webs of sea purple, wonderful to behold. There are springs of water, never dry. It has two doors, one turned to the north by which mortal men may descend, one on the south, meant rather for gods, by which men do not enter. But this is the road of the immortals. In that harbor they sailed, for they knew it well. The ship ran up on the beach half her length with a dash, for the oarsmen put a good pace on her. The men leapt on the shore and carried Odysseus out, rolled up in his blanket and white sheet, and laid him down on the sand, still heavy with sleep. All his goods were brought out by the sturdy fellows from the places where they had been packed by the forethought of Athena. These were piled up in a heap under the olive tree off the road, so that no chance wayfarer might pilfer before Odysseus awoke. Then the ship went home again. But the Earthshaker did not forget his threats of long ago against Odysseus, and he asked Zeus what he meant to do.
"Father Zeus, I shall never have any respect in our world, now mortal men pay me none. I mean the Phaeacians, who actually belong to my own family. Here's an example. I thought Odysseus was to reach home in all sorts of misery and tribulation. I did not bar his return altogether, because you had solemnly promised him that he should return. And now, here are these people bringing him over the sea in a fast cruiser, planting him down in Ithaca, giving him any amount of presents, bronze and gold in plenty, and woven stuffs, more than he could have collected from the spoils of Troy if he had come home with his share intact."
Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered,
"Bless my soul, my good Earthshaker, you mustn't say that. There is no disrespect for you among us gods. It would be a great shame to bombard our eldest and best with insults. If a man thinks himself strong enough to refuse you proper respect, you can pay him out some time yourself. Do as you like about it. What pleases you pleases me."
Poseidon, Earthshaker, answered, "That is what I should have done on the spot, Thundercloud. But I always have a wholesome fear of your temper, and I do my best to avoid it. Now then, what I should like to do is to smash that fine ship on the way back from their convoy, that they may stop at once and convey no more men over the sea, and then I will raise a ring of high mountains about the city." Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered, "Gentle creature, my temper thinks the best thing to be this. Wait till the ship is running in, and the whole city gazing at the sight, and turn it into stone close to the shore, and let the stone keep the shape of a ship that all the world may wonder. Then raise a ring of high mountains about the city." So Poseidon, Earthshaker, went straight to Scheria, and there he waited. As the ship came sailing in at full speed, the Earthshaker turned it into stone and rooted it firmly to the bottom by a blow from the flat of his hand. Then he went away. There was something for those people to talk about, the nation of seamen with their long oars. They spoke out their minds plainly. A man would stare at his neighbor and say, "Mercy on us, who has shackled our ship in full course? I saw her clearly just now." For they did not know what had happened. But Alcinous called them together and spoke.
"Ah me, I see now the ancient oracles come true, which my father told me. He used to say that Poseidon was jealous of us because we gave safe convoy to all men over the sea. He said that one day the god would smash a ship on the water after it had just returned from convoy and would raise mountains about our city. And now what the old man said is all coming to pass. Now then, take my advice and let us all do as I shall say. Give no more convoy to strangers who shall come to our city. Let us sacrifice 12 choice bulls to Poseidon, and then perhaps he may have pity and raise no lofty mountains about our city." Accordingly, the people in great fear prepared the bulls, and the lords and princes of the nation offered prayer to Poseidon, standing about the altar. Odysseus awoke. He lay on his native soil, and knew it not, since he had been long absent. For Pallas Athena herself, that divine daughter of Zeus, had covered the place with mist, that she might tell him everything first, and disguise him. She wished that his wife and friends might not know him until he had punished the wooers of his wife for their outrageous violence. For that reason she made him find the whole place unfamiliar, the long roads, the wide harbors, the sharp rocks, the growing trees. He leapt up and stood looking round on his native land. Then he slapped his two thighs with his open hands and cried aloud in perplexity, "More trouble for me! What kind of men live in this country where I find myself? Men of violence? Savages who know not justice? Or kind people that know right from wrong? Where can I bestow these goods? Where can I go myself? I wish they had stayed in Phaeacia. I might have gone on to some other powerful king who would have entertained me and helped me on my way. Now I do not know where to bestow all this, and I cannot leave the stuff here, or someone may come and steal. Ah, well, those Phaeacian gentlemen were not altogether just and right-minded men, or they would not have brought me to a strange country when they promised to take me to Ithaca and did not do it. May Zeus, who hears the suppliant's prayer, requite them, he that beholds the doing of men and punishes sinners. I will just count up and see if they have taken anything away with them." He counted the tripods and cauldrons and the gold and all the woven stuffs and missed nothing. Then he paced along the seashore, thinking with sorrow and grief of his native land. But now came Athena towards him, in the shape of a young shepherd, but someone who seemed to be delicately nurtured, like a gentleman's son. A cloak was folded about her shoulders, boots were on her feet, and she carried a javelin. Odysseus was glad indeed to see her and moved to meet her, and he spoke out plainly, "Welcome, my friend. You are the first I meet in this place. I beg you to do me no wrong, but save me, and save all this. I implore you, as if you were a god, and embrace your knees. Answer me truthfully, what is this place? What country is it, and what men live here? Is it some bright island, or the mainland shore sloping down to the sea?"
Athena answered with her bright eyes glinting, "You are foolish, sir, or you have come from a long way off, if you ask questions about this land. It is not so very nameless in the world. Many men know it, both those who dwell towards the east in the rising sun, and those who dwell westwards towards the misty gloom. I grant it is rugged and no place for horses, but it is not a bad place, although no one could call it broad. It grows a terrible lot of corn and makes its own wine. There's plenty of rain and luscious grass, good food for goats and good food for cattle, trees of all sorts, and plenty of water that never fails. Therefore, good stranger, the name of Ithaca has reached as far as Troy, which they say lies far away from the Achaean land." This made Odysseus glad indeed, after all his sufferings. full of joy to be on his native soil, he heard the words of Pallas Athenia, daughter of Zeus, and his answer was plain enough, but he did not tell her the truth, which he was careful to keep back, for he had always a good store of clever fables. "Yes, I have heard of Ithaca, even in the broad island of Crete, far over the sea. And now I have come here myself with all these goods. I left as much again for my sons, when I had to get away a banished man, because I killed a son of Idomeneus, I mean Orsilochus, the sprinter, who beat every living soul in the island with those quick feet of his. He wanted to rob me of all my Trojan booty, which I had won by such toiling and moiling, wars on land and voyages over the sea. The fact was, I would not be a servant to please his father, but kept a company of my own men. I ran him through with a spear as he was coming down from the country, where I waited for him off the road with a friend. It was a dewy night, and not a soul saw us. Nobody knew that I had killed him. When I had finished the business, I applied to some honest Phoenicians, who were there with a ship, and I paid them a handsome fee out of my booty to take me on board for Pylos, or the fair land of Elis, where the Epeans are in possession. But the wind drove them away from those parts. They could not help it. They had no wish to deceive me. From there we were carried out of our course to this place in the night. We just managed to get into this harbor. We had no thought for food, though we were hungry enough, but just came ashore every man and lay down where we were. I was so weary that I fell into a deep sleep. The others brought out my goods from the ship and left them beside me on the sand. They have gone off to Sidon, and here I am, left behind, worse luck. Athena smiled, and her bright eyes flashed, and she stroked him with her hand. Now she looked like a tall and majestic woman, clever and intelligent, and she spoke to the point. A cunning rogue he would be, master of craft, who would outwit you. Even a god couldn't do it. Irrepressible, everlasting schemer, indefatigable fabulist. Even in your own country you wouldn't desist from your tales and your historiological inventions, which you love from the bottom of your heart. But no more of this. We are both clever enough. You are the paragon of mankind at planning and storytelling, and I have a name among the gods for cleverness and intelligence. And you didn't know Pallas Athenia, the daughter of Zeus himself, your faithful standby and guardian in all your labors. And it was I who made the Phaeacians kind to you. Well, here I am again to make plans for you, and to hide your treasures, which the generous Phaeacians bestowed upon you, all my doing, let me tell you, and to explain the dangers which fate has waiting for you in your own home. Be patient, for you must. Say not one word either to man or woman living. Don't tell a soul that you have come back from your wanderings, but suffer all in silence, and put up with the violence of wicked men. Odysseus was not taken aback, but he answered at once, It is a difficult thing, goddess, for a mortal man to know you at sight, even a man of experience. You turn yourself into all sorts of shapes. One thing I do know, that you were gracious to me long ago when we Achaeans were fighting at Troy. But after we had sacked the tall city of Priam and embarked and guards scattered the fleet, I did not see you then, O daughter of Zeus himself. I did not notice you on board my ship when I wanted someone to help me. I had to go drifting about in misery and wretchedness until the gods freed me from my troubles. That was before you encouraged me in the Phaeacian land and led me into the city yourself. Now I implore you by your father, for I do not think this is my beloved Ithaca, but some other country where I find myself. I think you are only making fun of me to bewilder my mind. Tell me if this is really Ithaca, my home. Athena answered with flashing eyes, Ah, you are always the same. No one can catch you napping, and that is why I cannot desert you in misfortune, because you are so charming and discreet and always ready for anything. Any other man after those long wanderings would have been eager to see home and wife and children. You do not choose to ask anything of anyone until you make sure of your wife by your own observation. And she, let me tell you, just stays at home while she weeps the nights and days away. But I never doubted. I knew quite well that you would return at last after losing all your men. The truth is, I did not wish to quarrel with Poseidon, who is my father's own brother, and he was furious because you blinded his son. Look here, I will show you the landscape of Ithaca, and then you will believe me. This is the harbor of Phorcys, the old man of the sea. This is the olive tree with its long leaves. This is the vaulted cave where you have offered so many solemn sacrifices to the nymphs. There is Neriton Hill, covered with woods. With these words the goddess dispersed the mist, and the land became visible. And Odysseus was filled with joy after all his troubles, and kissed the fruitful earth. Then he lifted up his hands and uttered a prayer to the nymphs. Naiad nymphs, O daughters of Zeus, I thought I was never again to see you. But now accept my greeting and my loving prayers. I will make my offerings also as I used to do, if the guiding daughter of Zeus graciously allows me to live and my son to grow. Athena answered him, Take courage, do not let that trouble you. But now let us put away these treasures far within the sacred cave, that they may remain in safety. We will consider between us how to manage for the best. The goddess entered the dark cave and searched about for hiding places, while Odysseus brought up the stuff, gold and bronze and clothing, which the Phaeacians had given him. All this they stowed away carefully, and Pallas Athene, daughter of Zeus Almighty herself, placed a stone before the mouth. Then the two sat down under the olive tree and discussed how to make an end to the riotous gallants. Athena began by saying, Prince Laertiades, you are a man never baffled, and now is the time to consider how you may lay hands on those shameless men who for 3 years have been lording it in your house and paying court to your incomparable wife. She longs continually for your return, keeps them in hope, makes promises to each, proposes this and that, while she has quite other things in her heart. Odysseus said, I do declare I should have met the same cruel fate as Agamemnon Atrides in my own house, if you had not told me clearly what has been going on, my goddess. Come on, weave me a plan to punish them. Stand by my side, give me unfailing courage, as when we tore the pretty veil from Troy's head. If you stand by me in earnest, Bright Eyes, I could fight 300 men with you, my queen and goddess, so long as you would really help me. Athena said to this, Of course I will stand by you. I will not forget you when we are about this business. I think those men who woo your wife and devour your wealth will soon bedabble the floor with their own blood and brains. Now then, I will disguise you so that no one will be able to know you. I will shrivel up the sound flesh of that muscular body. I will sweep off the brown crop from your head. I will wrinkle up those beautiful eyes. I will give you rags to wear, which anyone would be sick to see on a human being. And you shall seem like a shabby vagabond to the proud gallants, and even your own wife and son. But you must first pay a visit to the old man who looks after your pigs. He is always loyal to you, loves your son and your faithful Penelope. You will find him among his pigs. They feed near the Raven's Rock and Arethusa Spring, with plenty of acorns to eat and clear water to drink, which makes a good fat pig. Stay with him there and let him talk, while I go to Lacedaemon and bring back Telemachus. Yes, Odysseus, your own son, from the land of handsome women. He has gone to the lawns of Lacedaemon to ask Menelaus about you and to find out whether you are still alive. Odysseus very naturally asked, And why on earth didn't you tell him, since you knew all about it? Did you want him to see how he likes drifting over the sea in despair? The sea is barren enough, and these men are devouring his wealth all the time. Athena replied, Now don't worry too much about him. I went there with him myself, that he might win some credit in the world. There's nothing the matter with him. He is staying peacefully in the palace of Atrides, living in luxury. It is true there are some young fellows waiting for him in a ship, intending to murder him before he gets home. But I don't think that will happen. The men who are devouring his wealth will be dead and buried before that. As she said this, Athena passed her rod over Odysseus. She withered the sound flesh of his muscular body. She swept the flaxen crop from his head. She made the skin of every limb like the skin of an old man. She wrinkled up his beautiful eyes. She changed his clothes into a shirt and a lot of filthy old rags begrimed with foul-reeking smoke. Upon this, she threw a big hart skin with the hair worn off.